welcome everybody to the Saturday morning live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Sandy Beach and I'm an alcoholic. How you all? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And we have a lot of new people here today, and I'll just briefly mention that preamble is a quick reminder of what this organization is and what everybody is doing here this morning. And I've come to look at it as a very simple fact that we're able to do something as a group that none of us was able to do on our own. And namely, to stay sober and happy at the same time. And I'm one who believes that this is an essential ingredient in long-term sobriety. And if you're in AA and you're not happy, you're doing it wrong. It's that simple. And it puts it on your back to figure that out and to get a handle on this program so that the power of it can come in, because it's real hard to stay miserable and sober for a long time. Eventually, it just runs out. And in the next 45 minutes, we're going to try and get through three steps. So I will have to regroup real fast. This opportunity is particularly welcome to me. I feel that in sharing about the 12 steps is something I can do with a lot of enthusiasm. I do it with the hopes there's some new people here that will find something useful out of it. Before I get rolling on that, I always like to point out that in the program, if someone is sharing on the steps or their story, whatever it might be, that there isn't anybody who is the ultimate expert on anything in AA. We're just one drunk sharing with another one. And if something that you hear is confusing or it doesn't seem like it's acceptable, why, maybe I said it wrong, maybe you heard it wrong, we urge you to talk to us or talk to your sponsor. The program and these principles are designed to be quite flexible, to give us some elbow room, especially in the beginning. It was a program that was put together by drunks, for drunks. It was not developed by college professors, and the early drunks knew themselves very well, and they knew that the thing was structured in a way that said, you will do this, there would be nobody at the meetings. I mean, it's just that simple, that you tell a drunk that he has to do something, and he does just the opposite. That's just the nature when we first arrive here. So it's very interesting. If you look at the 12 steps, you'll see that you're not in them if you're brand new and you're just hearing about them for the first time. Your name isn't mentioned or anything, thou shalt do this. It's all a report of action taken by the people who came before you, and it is presented in a manner that you can see the results first. And so it is doesn't require as big a leap of faith as one might think. This program recently celebrated its 50th anniversary and was started by two guys from Vermont who ended up in Akron, Ohio. And one of them was a physician and one of them was a stockbroker. And both of them had been exposed to a thing called the Oxford Group, which was something that preceded Alcoholics Anonymous, where people, not alcoholics, just regular people, were getting together in an attempt to simply try and become better people. I take my hat off to the human beings in the world like that. I am astounded that it exists. I can't, I just don't seem to make progress until I feel the heat. Obviously, there's some people of higher character who do it through choice. Very interesting proposition, but we don't find that many here. But out of this came the guidelines and principles that were incorporated into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mention that because the steps are really a group of principles, as the foreword to the 12 and 12 says, which are spiritual in nature, and if we practice them as a way of life, they'll do two things. They'll get rid of the obsession to drink, and they'll enable the suffering alcoholic to become happily and usefully whole, which is an interesting goal, happily and usefully whole. These principles have been borrowed from religions and philosophies and medicine, and have been around for as long as man has found some mechanism of dealing with life on a spiritual basis. And so there really isn't anything in the 12 steps that is new. What's new is who is presenting it and the manner in which it is presented. And it came through the trial and error of the early days. And as we find out, much of it was borrowed from existing history. Unfortunately, in the Oxford group, it wasn't working well for the alcoholics, because it's very difficult to practice spiritual principles and drink. This was the main dilemma that they seemed to have. There was great sincerity, especially on Dr. Bob's part, in the group out in Akron. I mean, we're talking about trying this over a period of a couple of years. And his wife, and then some wonderful neighbors, and they're there, and they're meeting, and sort of similar to an AA meeting, and they're talking about a higher power and certain spiritual principles. And then you go home and drink. And they just don't mix well together. And very often we find in the early days in the program, we'll find people who are trying to find an easier, softer way. And I remember it occurring to me, gee, if I could work the steps while drinking until I have a spiritual awakening, it'd be real easy to quit then. Because you'd be a new person, or whatever happens to you when you have one of those things, whatever that means in the 12th step, maybe I could get it done that way. But it's you realize the problems involved. It's hard to get back out of jail, and it's hard to get back out of nut wards, and there's all these things that interfere with the plan. And so it wasn't working that well for the drunks in the Oxford group, but it was working for in human beings' lives, and it did work in a friend of Bill's. And I just would talk about this little story as a lead-in to the program as a whole. Back in 1934, Bill, our stockbroker co-founder, had reached the absolute bottom. He had lost a fortune that he had made on Wall Street and was basically unemployed, had been hospitalized a number of times. His wife was now working, and he was borrowing money out of her pocketbook in order to go to the bar to get the creative thoughts generated in your head so that you can then amass a fortune and put the money back in the pocketbook. You remember that train of thought. And it was on one of those Saturday mornings that she had gone off to work, and he had pulled out his hidden bottle of gin to settle into some serious creative thinking, when the phone rang and his old drinking buddy, Ebby, wanted to come by and see him, and he was all excited about this visit. He hadn't seen him in a while, but he was disturbed with one thing, and it was that Ebby was sober, and it had Bill quite upset and nervous. When your drinking buddy is sober and sounds good, you know something is wrong. You know what I'm talking about. And when he arrived at the kitchen table, Bill saw there was many things wrong. He looked good, he was healthy, he was smiling, his eyes were clear. And the first words out of his mouth were, "Bill, I've got religion. And this has to be the lowest moment that you can imagine." When you're sitting there with your bottle of gin and your old friend is showing up, and he looks good, and he starts talking about having religion. And this was very disconcerting. But he was quite persuasive about this Oxford group that he had been involved in. And he got carrying on with Bill into sort of a discussion. And it was at that point in time that Bill expressed his hostility to the idea of a higher power. He had been involved in church as a child and had thought it all through and had dismissed it as just being something that wasn't going to work in his life. There was too much dogma. It was too restricted, and it was too confusing, and besides, it was just didn't work. And during this discussion, Ebby came up with the idea, which he presented to Bill, why don't you choose your own concept of God? The wonderful thing, and of course you see that has been adopted into Alcoholics Anonymous, the one thing that is beautiful about that is it's hard to argue against it. It really takes everything away from you. You've got all that hostility to the thing, and they go, well, then you just come up with whatever you want. And it's hard to go, that's not acceptable. You know what I mean? And so it just catches you off guard, and you suddenly have to open your mind up a little bit, which is what, and it stuck with Bill, and during his next hospitalization, obviously he didn't stay sober or anything, it just stuck with him as an idea. And during his next hospitalization, in the recovery process, why he did cry out for a higher power to help him, and had a rather pronounced spiritual phenomenon occur to him that certainly doesn't occur to the vast majority of people. Most of us have the garden variety change that takes place in our sobriety, but in Bill's case, it was one of these singular events where in the matter of a few minutes he had experienced a great freedom from alcohol and a great sense of hope about the future. He essentially went from a very bleak outlook all in the matter of a few moments into a great expectation about the future and the freedom from alcohol and a realization that he had come close to his higher power and really experienced something in great depth. And the wonderful thing, we owe a great debt of gratitude to the psychiatric profession at this moment in time, because you got to realize we're in the lockup place and you call the psychiatrist to describe what just happened. And there was a wonderful chance that the doctor could have said, oh, forget it, man, that was just the DTs. And that may have been a great detour in the origin of AA had that happened, but Dr. Silkworth was not a person like that, and he was quite familiar with spiritual principles and the spirituality that it can be used in recovery, and he did not dismiss it, but rather encouraged Bill to take advantage of it and explain that these events do happen to human beings and that it does change their lives significantly, and that he should mark it as a great moment of hope, which Bill did. And he went forth from that day and never had another drink, and charged out with the enthusiasm of someone who had something like that to sober up the world. And we still see that in AA. In the early months, many of us go racing off to the bars of our friends with the good news that they don't have to suffer anymore. Joe, put down the beer. You don't have to suffer anymore. And Joe says, I'm not suffering. Go away. But we all know that great message carrying that you have in there. I can't believe it's possible to get up in the morning and not puke and go to work, and I've been to work 11 days in a row, and tell people at work, I've been here 11 days in a row, and someone says, I've been here for 11,000 days in a row. Hardly a record. And we soon learn that we're excited about doing things that people have been doing for forever, you know. We just have latched on to a little bit of life for the first time. And so this enthusiasm led Bill out into all over the place telling people about sobriety and how wonderful it was. And he's now got 3 months and going around sharing this message. And you got to realize the message was kind of will put you off a little bit when you come up and go, let me tell you, I was sitting there and all of a sudden a bright light came into my room and I heard the wind blowing and I felt like I was on a mountaintop. And the guy says back to him, that happens when I drink rum. If our program was built on that, we just would still be getting off the ground, but that's the only experience that Bill had to share, and so he was desperately trying to share this, going around out of great generosity, sharing this good feeling with people and getting no one sober, but he still had his heart was in the right place, and he was simultaneously putting together a business deal with a machine tool company in Akron, Ohio that made various machines for the rubber processing, and if he could get this proxy deal put together, he would end up being the president of this new company, and that would be appropriate for an alcoholic who's been all the way down, is to make a full recovery back to a millionaire in 6 months. Only, right, why waste time? Let's get there in a hurry. And so our co-founder certainly had the same impatience that many of us have. How am I going to get everything back fast? And out he went to Akron. And we all know the story that the deal fell through and his business associates came back to New York and he was left there for another couple of days to wrap things up and alone in the Mayflower Hotel. And it occurred to him that life just wasn't quite right. And how could this happen to him? He tried so hard, not drinking anymore, being a good guy, and look at this terrible deal. And he stood in the lobby of the Mayflower and heard the piano music coming out of the bar and heard all the laughter in there and just said, you know, I could go in, cheer myself up a little bit, and then go back to New York. And suddenly it dawned on him that that would probably mean absolute death and back to the insane asylums. And his eyes went to the other side of the lobby and he saw a list of church directories. And it was out of a sense of desperation that he got the names of some ministers off of that list and called them in order to find a drunk that he could go talk to so that he could stay sober. It wasn't anyone giving anything away. It was, I got to go work with somebody for my own sobriety. And the minister, Reverend Tunks, led him to Henrietta Seiberling of the Seiberling Millionaires, and she was a member of the Oxford group, and she said, do I have a drunk for you? Yes, I do know someone. He is and it was Dr. Bob, who, little did Dr. Bob know that he was about to have a 12-step call played on him. And Henrietta called up Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, and said, good news, there's a man in town from New York who knows all about staying sober, and I just know that if we get Dr. Bob together with him, that all will be well. So let's set up a meeting right now. And Ann said, I'm sorry, I agree with you, we got to have the meeting, but we'll be unable to hold it today because tomorrow is Mother's Day and Dr. Bob went out to buy me a Mother's Day present and he just came home with a potted plant and he and the plant are under the table right now. And neither one of them is moving. And so, it looks like the meeting will have to be tomorrow. So now we got our co-founder, Dr. Bob, well-known Akron surgeon, lying under the table. And when he wakes up with his hangover, he is greeted with the wonderful news from his wife that there's a guy from New York who knows all about staying sober. And they're going to meet with him. You remember how we just got led around? You're going to meet with this and that. And Dr. Bob said on the way over, I'll give him 15 minutes. You know, the famous last words. And they met in the gatehouse of the Seiberling estate. And the meeting lasted for 5 hours. There was that instant chemistry between two people who suddenly realized that they desperately needed each other, that together they could do something that was, they just knew they were on to something. And that was the origins of this fellowship of AA. And it was trial and error as it grew in the early days and years. Dr. Bob was quite distinguishing for a number of reasons. And I suppose the first thing he did was to have AA's first slip. And he did that about 5 or 6 weeks sobriety. He suddenly realized, as so many new people, I've had pigeons who do this, that about 6 weeks sobriety, they suddenly go, I've neglected my education all these years, and I'm taking off this weekend for a seminar on economics in Las Vegas. Anyway, Dr. Bob went off to a medical convention in Atlantic City and came back drunk and had to perform an operation the next morning, and Bill worked with him all night trying to get him his hand steady enough, and as the story goes, they gave him a bottle of beer a half hour before the operation to keep his hand steady, and he went in, performed the surgery, and that was his last drink. And so bad that AA got started back in 1935, and here we are 50 years later with 1.5 million people in over 100 countries. And the basic ingredient in all of this success is the 12 steps. These 12 steps are what individual AA members all over the world end up using as a way of life. It seems that most of us with our alcoholism missed out on life 101. You know what I mean? We know a lot of things, but we just don't have a handle on how you just sort of get through a day, you know, one of those basic things. And since you're, you know, we get here and we're 25, 35, 45, 55, 65, whatever age we get here, it's real hard to own up to the fact we haven't figured it out yet. And we just pretend everything's fine and that we know certain things. But deep down inside, we are filled with resentments and anger and self-pity and fear and anxiety and confusion, and none of it makes any sense. It never has. We have a very cynical look at the world. We don't really trust people. We're not too excited about the future. We'd rather forget about the past. And there isn't too many comfortable places we can park. And we're always on the move, you know, just keep moving. I'm here and it's not comfortable here. I'll sit over there. It's not comfortable there. I'll go to a movie. I don't like the movie. And everywhere we go, we're there. That's our problem. When we first get here and just learn about alcoholism and learn that we're powerless over alcohol and we encounter our first step, we're apt to be given the wrong impression that the mere knowledge of our situation will carry us through. And in the writings of the AA literature, Bill mentions this many, many times. He probably mentions this as much as anything, is that self-knowledge avails us nothing. In other words, it serves no purpose to know that we're an alcoholic and to learn about alcoholism as a disease and it does this and it does that. If that's all we had to rely on, we would then have what we call an educated drunk. We have someone who is lying on the floor, drunk, but knows exactly why. Whereas before, we were lying there wondering why. I wonder what the problem is. Now we lie there, same, just as drunk as ever, and we know exactly why we're there. Well, I'm here, I'm an alcoholic. I have this thing and I have that. But it doesn't help in sobriety, knowing that it does, that has no bearing on it, because that's not our problem. Our problem is not ignorance of alcoholism. If that's all it was, we would just go take a crash course at Rutgers or someplace, walk out with a PhD in alcoholism and never drink again. But our problem is phrased well in the first step. It says we're powerless over alcohol. So the only answer to the being powerless is power. We have to somehow get the resources, the wherewithal, to stay sober, and it can't be done on our own, and so it is something that we get out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it is very important to come to grips with that in our first step. Big Book talks about there's no defense against the first drink. Bill writes about we don't have the same kind of defense that you have when you go to put your hand on a hot stove. In other words, it's almost as if the mechanism, you don't really think about that. You're walking in there and your hand wanders near the gas burner as you're doing this, and it comes back all by itself. You know how that whole process, and then you look over, hey, stove is on. You don't go like this, I smell something burning. Hey, I wonder if I left the gas on, you know, and the meanwhile the hand is melted off, you know, as we sit here and debate the issue. Am I really powerless over fire? It just boom. And so we have the same thing. We have all this knowledge. We have all this internalization of what our drinking did to us. Every time we drink, we go to jail. Every time this happens, if I drink again, the doctor told me my liver, I'll probably have a convulsion. I'll do that. And then this will probably, I just had a drink. It was like, it just came in. We had no defense against it. All of a sudden, the thought to have a drink found its way into our computer, and it was immediately followed by a drink. And then when we're asked later, how did that happen? We're at a loss to explain it. We just seemed to part company, and our track record goes on and on and on, where it is proven to us there is no way that we're not going to eventually take that first drink again. And this obsession to continually think about drinking stays with us, and the common denominator that we all have is we're unable to solve this dilemma on our own. So our first step of AA really takes us down this path of surrender, and we strongly suggest anybody who is new that you spend time on this and realize what 100% powerless means. The more you can come to grips with being totally, absolutely hopeless case, the happier your sobriety will be. It is one of our first paradoxes that total surrender will enable you to win. Because if we don't surrender to the first step totally, then the remaining steps are optional. You know what I mean? They're out there as things that we might want to engage in at some time, as opposed to this is what can get us out of this situation that the first step and surrendering in the first step did. I like to compare the transition from the first step to the second step because I used to fly with thinking about jumping out of a plane without a parachute. There's a certain feeling of control you have if you're dropping from 20,000 down to 500. You know what I mean? You see these free fallers and they can do figure eights and you just can really be free as a bird. But at the last moment, as the ground is coming up, it's very comforting to realize you have a parachute. It's sort of a very important feature of the trip, is to have that. And if you were to picture how you would feel as you watch from way up high, the relative motion, you don't pick up on it, and it just seems like it may take forever to get down there, but as closer you get, it just, boom, it starts moving up real fast. And it's right then when you go to grab the cord and you go, oh my God, the whole thing is gone, that you may have a sense of what the first step is all about, what being powerless over alcohol is. And if we could work it somehow, we would take everybody in who's brand new to AA and go up on top of a parachute tower and throw everybody off without a chute, just get that feeling of powerlessness. And about 10 feet from the ground, a hidden hand would shoot out and grab you at the last second, right before you hit, and would have a little voice that said, excuse me, we're conducting a survey. Do you believe in God? And that's the only way to move from step one to step two. If you do step one right, then step two becomes very appealing. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We would come to believe that there has to be a higher power because of the nature of the situation I'm in. You see what I mean? It removes all the debate over the issue. And if there's anything the second step is, it is a huge debate over the existence of a higher power for you. And all human beings seem to engage in this. And we are hardly the exception. The typical person who arrives in AA has become an agnostic, an atheist. And the question of coming to believe in a higher power brings out some great negative reactions in us. It hurts us right down to our gut as we start going, I don't mind admitting defeat, but you don't have to hit me with this God stuff just because I'm down. I mean, it just feels awful. And we are confronted with what I call the Jack Benny choice in the big book where... You know,